Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Enjoy this cool and short listicle provided by Dr. Arthur Vosloo from his book, Magic and Mysticism, based on philosopher Hans Jonas's existentialist depiction of Gnosticism. Here it is. 1. A hostile cosmos, Gnostic antipathy to nature. 2. A demiurge, or ignorant creator responsible for botched creation, and hostile to human spiritual awakening. 3. Dualism, opposition between the realm of light and the realm of matter. 4. An elaborate mythology. 5. Myths concerning Sophia, wisdom, and her fall and restoration. 6. Belief in a hidden god, not the demiurge. 7. Difficulty of spiritual progress due to the archons or other hostile powers in the cosmos. Ignorance of the inherent fallen human condition. 8. Existence of the Ogdoad, or 8 spheres, including 7 planetary spheres, and possibility of their transcendence. 9. The necessity of Gnosis, or direct spiritual knowledge from the realm of light. 10. A revealer or redeemer figure to show the way to the realm of light.
Valentinus believed the world we live in was created by a cruel god, and slightly stupid. A god that will send you plagues, or require sacrifices, or destroy Babylon.
He wasn't wrong about that. The bastard had a mean temper.
Humans can escape this world, and return to the real one. The kingdom. And for that, you needed to achieve the Gnosis, which could be described as true knowledge.
Happy heresies, and welcome to the desert of the real. Welcome to Aeon Byte, and welcome to perhaps a still a Hans Jonas world. At least when it comes to the cinematography of the Gnostics, I think Hans Jonas is still pretty cool. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am glad to see you. And I am so happy to see you here, oh, you spiritual entrepreneurs, you modern-day Tom Sawyers, your mind not for rent, any god or government. And today, I am very excited to discuss a topic and a very cool book and someone who I certainly admire and I follow, and I am very happy he's around, and that is Dr. David Litwa. David, thank you very much for coming back on the show.
Thank you, Miguel. Good to see you, and good to see you, Vance.
Yes, good to see you, Vance, in your digital form. How are you doing, Vance?
I'm okay. Had a busy day at work, but here I am on the show, and this will be a thrice great show, won't it?
Indeed. Yes, David is here to discuss his new book, The Hermetica One, the Corpus Hermeticum Ordered as a Path of Initiation. And I enjoyed it a lot. It certainly was a book I highly recommend for you guys to really understand this. So for everybody, yes, as always, if you have a question or a complaint against Vance and I, please super chat them so we can get to them. Good to see Anon Omos and Grandpong and Christina and others here at the chat. But yeah, if you have a question, please super chat them and we will get to them. Well, let's start with you, David. Tell us about the creation of this book, how you drew from the powers of the Pleroma to make it a reality.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I really appreciate the chance to come on and talk about it. I know a lot of people have been interested. I have a friend of mine who says that I've given him the Hermetic Bible, and I'm not sure if that's true, but my hope was to complete what I had started with Cambridge University Press by publishing Hermetica 2 way back in 2018 now. Seems like a different life, but I wanted to finish the task, and I wanted to do something that no one else had done, surprisingly, because since the mid-80s, we've recognized that with the scholarship of Garth Fouden and now more recently Jean-Pierre Mahay, and with Christian H. Bull, that what we have in the Hermetica is an order, and that the current order of the tractates doesn't, it's like a random jumble. The 1 to 17, they're like, I'm not sure how we got that particular order in the Renaissance, but it makes no spiritual sense. And one thing that we've recognized about the Hermetica since the 80s is that the Hermetica teaches different things because it assumes you're at a different grade or level of initiation. So why not try to order the tractates in order to correspond to what we think might be a plausible path of initiation. Now, I should say what I think. And all of that is a reconstruction, and it's inherently revisable. The readers should feel free to organize and read the tractates in whatever order they want. But I think it's important to recognize that there is an order, and I've given you my best shot at leading you through a spiritual progression. So that's the contribution of the text. I also, think that I provide two other distinctives, which you're not going to get with Copenhauer. Copenhauer's translation is good, but it's now based on a text that we recognize is not the best edition. And it's largely, I think, it has some terminology in there which is not really helpful for the spiritual practitioner. It's a little bit hard to read, and if you go to the endnotes, they're kind of choppy. So I've updated the translation. I've made it more smooth, and I've taken out what I consider to be foreign material. And I have also provided, after each tractate, what I'm calling a spiritual commentary. This is something which I probably couldn't pull off with a traditional academic press, which in part explains my decision to just go ahead and use the gods of Amazon. but the point is simply to be both historically rigorous, which, you know, I've built my reputation on doing that. I really want to actually get what they thought, not, you know, impose any kind of pattern on that is foreign to their thought. But secondly, I want to provide this as a true spiritual experience for actual Hermetic practitioners. So the book can be read by anyone interested in the Hermetica, but it is, I hope, spiritually useful to anyone who actually wants to take up the path and follow that path of initiation.
No, it makes sense. So what is the order then? How is it different, or how did you reorder it? And what are the themes the reader will get into it that you think makes more sense?
Well, let me get my volume here. so I don't say anything that's not accurate. Basically, I do start with the traditional gateway to the tractates, and that is the Poimandres. So I leave the Poimandres in first place. Okay, so I don't try to change that. But there are, in addition to the Poimandres, what I would consider to be introductory or aesagogic tractates that are more like exhortations to outsiders. And so this would be Tractate 7, which is simply like a short introduction telling you that, you know, the world is, there's something wrong with the world and there's something wrong with humanity. And that's why you should join our group, sort of like that. It's a bit evangelistic. And then with that tractate, I have attached what I consider another outsider tractate, Tractate 6, which says that basically the world isn't good, which caused a great deal of problems for past interpreters, because the Hermetica is overwhelmingly positive about the world. In fact, on many occasions, it identifies the world as the image and child of God, and even as God himself. So Tractate 6 was always a thorn in the side of interpreters. But I think if you recognize it as another one of these introductory evangelistic tractates, you can see why it would work for trying to get people into your community. But it's not the kind of teaching that you would give to actual insiders. And finally, the last evangelistic tractate is the famous Mixing Bowl tractate, which completes that series. And then in parts 2 and 3, I divide the tractates into what I consider to be general discourses and detailed discourses. This is a division that is inherent in the Hermetica themselves. So Hermes will constantly refer to, I said this and this in the general discourses. And in the titles to several of these tractates, we have the actual general discourses. And then Hermes will also refer to discourses where he's taken a much more deep dive, apparently for higher initiates. And these are the detailed discourses. I'm not going to go through every one of those, but I consider the detailed discourses to be some of these Jean-André Fastigia referred to as the cosmotheism tractates. That is where the world is God, that it's either panentheism or pantheism. So we've got tractate 11 and 5 and tractate 10, which is called the key. And then finally, the culmination of the series in part 4 is revelatory discourses. And here's where I will cover probably the most famous tractate on rebirth, Tractate 13. And unlike Copenhagen, I also bring in the 8th reveals the 9th from Nag Hammadi, otherwise known as the Discourse on the 8th and 9th. And I give you the Prayer of Thanksgiving from Nag Hammadi. By the way, I've got the Asclepius there too. The Asclepius, that long tractate only preserved in Latin, is in here. I don't try to separate it from anything, but I try to fit it into the spiritual progression. I view the Asclepius as kind of like a synthetic tractate that rolls a bunch of general discourses together. And so it's in part 2. So if you do get the book, you'll get all the Hermetica. So, and if you get Hermetica 1 plus Hermetica 2, literally you'll be all set. I mean, you will have the complete set.
Yeah, the full dope. So, yeah, that's interesting. You mentioned Christian Bull, and I remember listening to him on Schwepp, and he was always talking about scholars are confused because, yes, most people, especially New Agers and occultists, think, oh, Hermetica is all, you know, love and light, but there's dark passages in the Corpus Hermetica, Archons, the body and all that. So scholars were like, well, maybe it starts out that everything, barring from David Bowie's hunky-dory, and then at the end of the initiation, the world sucks, Gnosticism. Or it's the opposite, like you said, the world is bad, come on, join. And then at the end, whoa, no, the world's actually worth living for and fighting for. So do you see that too? That, again, there is that's how you compromise or harmonize why the Hermeticists had this apparent dualism?
Right, yeah. In the 80s with Garth Fouden and several other interpreters, they saw the pattern as moving from monism to dualism, is the way they phrased that. But I think Christian Bull is right, and his book, The Tradition of Hermes, is fantastic. I think the pathway is actually from dualism to monism, that the real Hermetic position that's overwhelmingly represented in the corpus is not only that the world is worth supporting and preserving, but that the world is simply just another manifestation of God. The world is God for all intents and purposes. So I really think that that in the end is the culmination of hermetic spirituality. And so, yes, that's a decision on my part, and it's a decision on the part of Christian, but I think that that's right. And that's why I would distinguish hermetic thought from, you know, obviously the Hans Jonas pattern of Gnosticism. I don't think that it will fit that pattern, but it does make use of some of that negative language in the beginning, you know. But I think that's more for like the shock value to get people into the group. You know, it's, as I say, it's more evangelistic in terms of its social function, but it's not the mystery.
Exactly. And for the message, as you write, the Corpus Hermeticum has been layered and changed and played with, but isn't, as the poet Charles Stein said, the text is the secret. In other words, it really is a personal, and as Justin Sledge said, a new age text that you are meant to figure out on your own. And that's, you know, like Mark Goodacre said about the Gospel of Thomas, that it is personal. He envisions there was a teacher, and he was like reading the Gospel of Thomas. He would ask his student, oh, what do you think about this saying? That, and at some point, like one student would be like, oh my God, aha, yeah, the inner and the outer. Oh my, and he'd have his moment of, everybody had their own entry point and interpretation. Kind of like, you know, David Lynch recently passed. People would ask David Lynch, well, can you summarize your movies? Like, the movie is the summary. You get what you want out of my movies or you don't. Do you think that's more or less what hermeticism is? Each of us is supposed to get something different at some point?
That's what it ends up as. I mean, I would say the same thing about the Bible too. But one thing that you mentioned is that, yes, it's personal, but it's personal in community. So it's not like you are sitting in an isolation tank. You can ask your fellow initiate what this passage means and get some feedback. And so it's not an echo chamber either. So you really are part of a community that is, I would say, cosmopolitan and worldly. There's no sense that hermetists are off in the desert somewhere. They are really connected to each other, and they're really connected to the world. They love nature. They absolutely do not reject nature. Nature is their Bible as well. So I think, yes, ultimately everyone will come to their own conclusion. But if you're not doing this in community, you sort of lost the point of the initiation. Every initiation, or I won't say every, but virtually every initiation assumes some sort of group. Mm-hmm. And one of the great advances in terms of hermetic scholarship, which also Christian Bull and Jean-Pierre Mahay have brought to us, is that there were real hermetic groups, and there can be real hermetic groups today, right? So I have this video called The 16 Principles in my course on Hermetica. It's an online course. And basically, I go through, you know, what are the 16 kind of root principles for being a hermetist. And that would apply in antiquity. It would apply today. And I know for a fact there are hermetist groups out there. I know for a fact that there are people reading this material together. And I know for a fact that they're asking me and wanting me to throw my oar in there. And I've seen people take my course on the Hermetica. And so, in fact, you know, you can consider this book like the textbook for the course, you know, and that course is meant for people to take together so that they can be in dialogue with me. And you can take it online in your underwear if you want, you know, but you are, none of us are really ever like fully alone, right? I mean, we will come to our personal conclusions, but we, in the end, we think nothing unless we think socially. So this is really what I would say.
Yeah, I would agree. But, and people may be asking, okay, this is great, beautiful text, very poetic. I love reading it, but What are the rituals getting your hands dirty? I mean, is it as simple as there was a hierophant and then you had the initiates around him, the hierophant sort of guided them to these altered states of mind? Or what would the community look like doing these rituals besides just reading it?
Well, that's the thing about the Hermetica. There are rituals, but it's not Baroque. It's actually a lot of the rituals are very, 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 very simple and straightforward. So there's often made mention of a kiss greeting. So you greet each other with a hug. I mean, and if you're in Mediterranean culture and Egypt was part of this culture, you give a kiss on both cheeks. If you're of Italian background, you know what I mean, you know? So, that's one of the rituals. Another ritual is early morning and late evening prayer. And so the prayer of Thanksgiving is the most famous example. This is something that I use myself. It's just such a beautiful prayer that I find it very useful to pray. And you're supposed to pray at sunrise looking east, and you also pray it at sunset. And there probably was some kind of, in terms of their practice, there probably was some limitation in terms of the diet, but nothing radical. The Asclepius mentions that they had their evening meal, which appears to be the only meal of the day. So they wait until sundown to have the meal. But in terms of like, were there like specific meditation rituals or the use of hypnotic mantras or anything like that? What's really striking about the Hermetica is the most famous example of like the Hermetic resistance to too much elaboration is right before the prayer of Thanksgiving. Asclepius says, should we light some incense? And Hermes is like, no, absolutely not. That's totally inappropriate. And, you know, like people have been really struck by that. But I think the point is that there definitely is ritual. It's just very simplified and streamlined, and it doesn't necessarily go much beyond the master, you know, walking the student through the text. Mm-hmm. Right. And you know, they do have an experience. I'm not trying to like reduce the experiential level. They do actually in their minds go to the eighth and ninth, but because they already believe that your higher consciousness is there already, so to speak, that it's infinite and that it's not in any kind of place, then essentially, you know, they don't need a large apparatus to get you to where you belong. They just lead you through this reading program, essentially. So, yeah, I would definitely agree that the reading is the most important part of all of this, whether you're reading it alone or in a group or both. Be reading it very slowly, meditatively. It's actually, they're very difficult texts. I wouldn't describe them as real well written, actually. There's a couple nice passages, obviously, purple passages, but you need to go slow. And I hope everyone will maybe not get the Kindle version, but just get the actual text, hold it in your hand and go nice and slow. And I think the rewards are rich.
For sure. And for people who said, well, let's say it's reading. I think, yeah, there's obviously meditation, contemplation, prayer, but people forget, especially in this day and age, that a good book can alter your consciousness forever, whether it's The Lord of the Rings or Rilke or, you know, somebody or Shakespeare. It can transform you and change your life. You can close that book and your life, reality looks different. So nothing wrong with reading, and especially if you've got a good teacher. So it's and you would say that the culmination of the Hermeticism is, or one of the tools would be Gnosis. And as David Brackey said, it's always ironic that the one thing that wasn't exclusive to the Gnostics is Gnosis. It was in all these traditions. So Gnosis and ignorance are the two extremes, right, David?
Yeah, right. There's a hermetic gnosis. Yeah. So, you know, some of the terminology can get confusing, but like in terms of the scholarly category of Gnosticism, where you have an evil creator and anti-cosmism and things of that nature, that's definitely not the Hermetica. That's kind of like the opposite of the Hermetica. But did Hermetists as an initiatory group say that they had special gnosis or knowledge? Well, absolutely. But again, that's not a special claim. And, you know, gnosis is sort of like fill in the blank. You know, it doesn't, the claim to have special knowledge doesn't tell you what that knowledge is. Hermetists had their own variant. And so, yes, there is a hermetic gnosis, absolutely. But I'm not sure at all that we would be served by calling them followers of Gnosticism. They're playing a different game and doing it really well. Another way to think of the Hermetica, which I encourage people to think of, is it's just late antique Egyptian spirituality, right? Mm. So, you know, a lot of people are really interested in Egypt. And for Westerners, I think the best way to get into Egypt is to go through the gateway that really most people since the Renaissance have gotten to it. And that is through the Hermetic writings. That was the exportation of Egyptian, native Egyptian, indigenous spirituality. Of course, it doesn't look exactly what it did, you know, to the Egyptians themselves, like in the New Kingdom, you know, way back in the day. But it was always meant to be something that, you know, would be understood to the Westerners of the day, which was the Greeks. And so we've taken up that mantle. And so that's why the Hermetic writings, you know, give us that access to Egypt.
At the same time, what about the sections when you have like the seven punishing archons? And it reminded me a lot of the Gospel of Mary and also Middle Platonism. There's these forces dragging you down. You've got to go up through. What do you say to those? Although some people say that's really just allegories for what's inside of us, right?
Sure. But if you go back to Egyptian mythology, you can find analogous characters in what's called the Amduat. I mean, if you read through the Egyptian Book of the Dead, I know there are many versions of it, but you can find the more or less equivalent to hostile gatekeepers who are monstrous. You know, there's some famous examples of this. So, you know, by the time we get to late antiquity, when these writings are written, they are certainly using that Greek language of daimones, and they've expanded their cosmology to think of terms of like the seven spheres of the cosmos. So that's definitely Greek influence. But in terms of the characters in the story, and the idea of hostile gatekeepers and the idea of judges of the dead. I mean, I think you could make the case that really the Egyptians had come up with these kinds of concepts hundreds, if not thousands of years before the Greeks ever did. And so they are, when they translate them, they have their own particular character and function, even as they're adapting to the new kind of Greek cosmology.
The Egyptians had that giant snake. I was going to call him Apu, but that's the guy from The Simpsons.
Apophis. Apophis.
Like, yeah. He's way, yeah. But they had their own things we had to overcome. It wasn't just an easy ride to the God beyond God or whatever. And the question that as always seems to confuse everybody, or maybe we're just never going to get a straight answer, and that's the idea of the news, the N-O-U-S. What's your best explanation for the news? Very important in Hermeticism.
Yeah, that's another distinctive I have. It's another difference from Copenhauer. So Copenhauer just translated news as mind, which I think pretty much everyone now recognizes that's a deeply problematic under-translation of what this is. It's really Wouter Honegraaff who has done the most recently to say how pathetic and inadequate most English translations are for Nous. And I'm not saying that I'm any better, but I do translate it by higher consciousness, sometimes by divine consciousness. So I'm trying to get at what I think is the main idea, that it's actually not a process of normal cognition. The Nous for most Hermetists, you know, and their usage varies, but when you get to the upper levels of initiation, Nous is going to designate that transcendental faculty of perception, which is consubstantial with God. It's not anywhere. It's not in any place. It's just a divine thinking. And that's who we are. That's what we're tapping back into. And it's not ratiocination. It's not calculation. It's not normal cognitive processes that follow brain architecture. It is actually something higher, which you would only achieve really in states of deep meditation or training. I'm trying my best. Obviously, you know, people might come up with something else, but I'm at least signaling to the reader that this is not your normal mind or intellect.
Yeah, because is it something that we all have? Is there a big news? Is it a goal we reach? You know, I get to confuse myself. Sometimes I think I'm going to get like, who was the great jazz player, Louis Armstrong, when they asked him, well, what's jazz? And he said, if I have to explain it, you're never going to know. So maybe that's what news is, right? What about?
Yeah, and the Hermetists themselves, they didn't always agree with each other. Yeah, that's something important to know. But even if you think that the Nous is in everybody, I think it ultimately comes down to the same thing. Whether you think it's an elite group or everybody, even if you think that it's everyone who has Nous, well, you still think that not everyone has immediate access to it. I mean, I don't have immediate access to Nous. Like I really think you'd seriously need about a half an hour of meditation before you'd even be ready to do anything like what they're talking about. So that's something to keep in mind.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
No, it makes sense. What about you, Vance? Oh, since you're Italian, you need two kisses before you can talk.
Right. Well, it's maybe what they were trying to get at is that not that everybody has a Nous or whatever, but everybody is in the Nous. In other words, you know, the monad projects out through its infinite cosmic intelligence, and that cosmic intelligence maps to a cosmic mind, so to speak. That's always the way I interpret it, at least. But I got a number of things, but one of the things is that I'm with David Lynch passing away brings to mind the TM, Transcendental Meditation, and the Vedas. Do you think the Hermeticists were similar in philosophy to the Vedic teachings? Because Vedic teachings pretty much have, you know, the cosmic, you know, the Brahma, and they have the, you know, meditation and getting into the cosmic mind and so forth. What do you think about that connection, if any?
Vance, I think there's probably a connection, but I don't know enough about Vedic teaching to give you anything specific. That's just a gap in my knowledge. I don't. Unfortunately, I can't bridge East and West. One thing that I can tell you is that definitely Indian, what we consider to be Indian philosophy or Hindu philosophy, had reached Egypt by late antiquity. So, you know, there's no reason to think that they wouldn't have had some kind of connection, that they wouldn't have had some kind of conversation with that material. Yeah, those trading routes to India, they all went through the Red Sea. So you go south in Egypt until you hit the Red Sea, and then you come out of the Red Sea and you finish the journey to Egypt. So that stream is there. So I would presume that there's probably a fair bit of communication and exchange there. I just can't, you know, give you any quick points of connection, because I'm not an expert at all in that material.
How about this then? How about the perennial philosophy? Do you think the perennial philosophy has its roots in Hermeticism, or Hermeticism has its roots in what is the perennial philosophy, which may come out of the noose? Or what do you think about that?
Well, I don't know. I sense that perennialists, they very much depend on the Hermetica. And it is the case that, you know, if you've read Hermetica 2, that some people think, you know, after late antiquity, we kind of lost our knowledge of Egypt. But that's not really the case. A lot of these Arab Muslim writers, they kept the tradition alive, and then their Arab writings moved into Latin. And so there's Hermetica, you know, the Hermetica never disappears off of the radar. I know people make obviously a big deal about Ficino and coming up with the first translation of the Corpus Hermeticum in the 15th century. But one of the reasons that was viewed as significant is because they'd never really forgotten about Egyptian wisdom and Hermes. So, but I don't think that we could identify like all those various streams as one coherent thing that we would refer to as perennial philosophy. I'm too much of a hard-headed historian to want to say that there has been, if I understand it, that just kind of one ultimately ground and stream of tradition. I really think that it's a little bit more like let a thousand flowers bloom. And there will be continuities in any kind of spirituality, because not necessarily because of diffusion, partially because of diffusion, but also because of similar brain structures. I mean, in the end, Homo sapiens, it's kind of like we're vanilla. We killed all the others. But, you know, we all have the same basic brain. So I'm not at all surprised that the human brain would be able to pick up on any kind of theme that would be repeated in these kinds of deeper spiritual philosophies. But I'm just, I don't put any particular stock on continuity. I see a lot of difference in this material as well. And I'd rather, you know, I think it's a matter of honoring the material where you point out, you know, where these people are actually trying to be distinctive and saying, you know, we're actually different from that group over here. I think Hermes is really, really nervous about Greek philosophy. And there's some famous passages in the Hermetica where he's like, you know, anything written in Greek is just noise, you know, which is ironic because this material ends up in Greek. But I think, you know, as in our own day, like these people are trying to say that they are very distinctive. And so I'm just trying to honor that, I guess, is my attitude.
Yeah, there aren't any Hermetic texts that are actually Egyptian, are there? I mean, or even Coptic? Do we have any that actually? Because I've always been wondering why Hermeticism is different than, say, Platonism or Gnosticism, whatever. There doesn't seem to be any churches or Hermetic schools that we know of in history, or maybe I'm wrong about the Hermetic schools, but maybe I just don't know. But seems to be floating through history And we were talking about hermetic communities, but I'm not sure there's any historic record of such communities or whatever. So what can you tell us about that? You know, the actual practicing or institutionalization, so to speak, of hermeticism.
Well, there's no archaeology. You know, we haven't found a building with an inscription saying this is a hermetic.
Hot luck on Sundays.
Bingo. Greek bingo.
Right. Bingo. And, you know, maybe we will find something like that. Maybe we won't. I mean, the issue is people aren't looking for that because they don't believe that it's there anyway. But even if we found, you know, a hermetic building or some kind of amulet, or we wouldn't know whether it's hermetic because we really can't distinguish hermetic from just plain Egyptian. I mean, let's face it, there are hundreds of thousands of artifacts that are found in Egypt and have been found in Egypt and elsewhere, you know, that, you know, a representation of Tot, for instance, or Thoth as the ibis. You know, I mean, I have that on the cover of Hermetica 1. We know that that's a very common image. So, you know, we found that as an artifact, but did that belong to a hermetist? Well, we can't answer the question because the object doesn't talk back to us. I mean, anyone can have the object. What we do know is that, yeah, our sources for thinking about, you know, actual hermetic groups, and I think it's fair to call them schools. I would even be happy calling them churches. Giles Quispel, you know, thought of a Masonic lodge, right. Which is probably as good as analogy as any. I'm not, you know, disputing any of that. I think there were concrete groups. They probably met in normal houses, just like early Christians did. And yeah, your courtyard or your back room would be a perfect place for a hermetic initiation if you had, you know, somebody with a nice house. That's what we're envisioning. But yes, the evidence for the groups comes from the texts themselves. The texts themselves talk about the rituals. There's no archaeological confirmation of that. So if people want to be skeptical, absolutely they can be. You know, I mean, go to town with that. If you think that it's just texts, that's fine. Or if it's just an audience cult, that's fine. I'm not going to, like, we don't need to die in a ditch for that one. But I think, you know, the important thing is that you get some spiritual value and meaning out of this. And, you know, that how, you know, you decide how you want to engage with this material. And if you can do it in community, great. That would be great. Maybe your community is just a chat group. Maybe you've never seen their faces, you know. That's okay. Yeah. There was an initial part to your question, which I've now forgotten, but anyway.
Yeah, I think it was about Coptic, which Coptic,
yeah.
Hermetic text in the Nag Hammadi library are Coptic.
Yeah, no, I translated Coptic to get you the discourse in the 8th and 9th. So that only survives in Coptic. I've given you the prayer of thanksgiving in the Coptic translation. And I've also given you the Coptic. When I translate the Asclepius, I give you the Coptic portion of the Asclepius. So I go from Latin to Coptic to Latin. And the reason why I do that is because that Coptic portion in Nag Hammadi is much more accurate, I think, than anything that the Latin translator did. The Latin translator is more like writing a paraphrase. So absolutely. And are there hermetic materials that are native Egyptian? Absolutely. That there's something called, if you Google the Book of Tot or Thoth, you'll see it's a native Egyptian dialogue of Hermes with a student. And it's not in Greek. It's not even in Coptic. It's Demotic, which, you know, is scribal Egyptian language. And so I can't read that stuff. It's very fragmentary, but it looks like a hermetic text, but it doesn't talk about the stuff that we would find in the, you know, the Hermetica for Westerners, you know, which is like the Corpus Hermeticum. It's much more concerned about what would be considered like traditional topics for like Egyptian priests, basically.
Yeah, in other words, the tradition, theology of Egypt, the Ba and the Ka, and the king going with his slaves to the in the boats and so forth.
Some of that, yeah. Also, just stuff about animals and plants, and you know, it's worth a read. Yeah.
But so the Hermetic texts, from what I understand, didn't sort of appeared at least along with or after the Gnostic texts, didn't they? Are there any that we know that were sourced before Gnosticism?
Well, so this material, you know, they don't come with timestamps. So unfortunately, especially with the Hermetica, I think the traditional dating is anywhere from first to third century. But I'll be honest with you, I've been a scholar of this material for now well over a decade, and I have no clue why they even come up with that range. there's just not a lot of footholds, because they don't make any reference to any kind of political events. All of that is speculation. And yeah. All that we know is that we don't get references to Hermetic literature really until Tertullian, who's early third century. And after Tertullian, you get a lot of Christian interest in the Hermetica. People start citing it a lot up until about the sixth century. And then, yeah, the Arab interpreters kind of take over. So presumably it was before the third century, but we don't know how much was before. Some people think that there was an old Hermeticism and a neo-Hermeticism. So like people like taking the old tractates and updating them in the fourth and fifth century, you know, changing stuff, adding stuff. They're all kind of moving targets. So if you view Gnosticism like me, as a real thing, but as more or less a Christian phenomenon of Christian groups arising in the second century who were coming up with the idea of the evil creator as Yahweh, then I would just say that these are probably more or less roughly contemporary texts. They seem to have some knowledge of each other. Like there's a famous polemic in the Hermetica against the evil creator. And so presumably, you know, he's talking about something. He's talking about people he knows who are saying that stuff. Presumably that would be Christian Gnostics. But there's nothing much specific. They're just kind of all in the same bowl, so to speak, the same mixing bowl, the same cauldron, and coming up with some very different ideas and stories.
Great. Well, thank you.
Yeah, very cool. But at the same time, talking about perennialism and all that, I mean, we can say, and please correct me from your book, that to the Hermeticists, the idea of what the role of humanity is that we have forgotten that we are God on earth. I mean, we need to wake up to our origins through this information, and we will be back. We will be God. I mean, that's it. Very much. Kind of like the Gnostics too, right? We forgot we were God, and we forgot that transcendent God was part of us, and now we need to make our way back home, which of course you find in the East in certain traditions.
Well, so this is what I mean by the similar cognitive structures. Like I think if we tell the story in a very general, abstract sort of way, we could do a good job of trying to fit a lot of groups together. But again, as a historian, I just like to say like the devil is in the details. So what I would really urge people to do is, so if you want to learn about Gnosticism and its Christian variant, so go read the Apocryphon of John or the Secret Book of John. Right. And that'll tell you the story of creation. And then if you want to know the Hermetic story of creation, go read the Kori Kosmu, which is in Hermetica 2. And tell me what you think is similar and different. And so this is a useful task for students. And when they read those two texts, like those abstractions and generalities, which you're referring to, they're totally overcome by the differences. So in the Kori Kazmu, there's no evil creator, there's no wisdom figure, there's no fall of Sophia, there's no number speculation. And it's really just a story about how we, our souls were made from a cauldron consisting of God's breath and fire. They were, we were set in control of the zodiac. We didn't do a good job, so we all fell into bodies, and then Isis and Osiris came to help us. And that's kind of it in a nutshell. And it doesn't sound very much like the Apocryphon of John. Although on a general level, you know, you might say, well, maybe Isis and Osiris are the revealer figures. Maybe, you know,
the fall. We fell, or something else fell, right?
There's still a fall. Yeah. So it depends on how general you want to get. You know, in the world today, there are clumpers and splitters, right? So there are people who like to clump these together, and then there are people who like to split them apart because they're more detailed oriented. This is almost a matter of personality. But if you're a clumper, anyone can be a clumper as long as you can think generally, you know. And of course, the more generally that you think in terms of abstract patterns like fall, return, stuff like that, then sure, you could class these people together. I always think that it's useful to read these people together. It's just that I'm not convinced they're at all saying the same thing, or that they live the same kind of lives, or that they have the same sort of rituals or attitudes or anything like that. It's just that I'm much more of a detailed person, you know. It's in my blood as a historian. So
yeah, I don't think Miguel or myself think that they're all the same, or there's, you know, they're very similar or whatever. But it's interesting. If you figure the universe, there's some sort of truth as to how the universe was generated, right? And maybe none of the groups knows it for sure. We all come up with a different versions, you know, like the elephant being looked at from different places, right? That old saw. Then you kind of try to pick the truth out from each particular tradition. And I think that's why the clumpers, you know, like myself in this instance, try to see, you know, what's common. But were there emanations in the Kori Kazmu? I forget. Did they have, you know, the monad like emanated anything, or are they just, what was the role of the monad? I mean, the monad.
In the Corpus Hermeticum creation story is more son of man emanations than the fall.
More like Genesis.
Son of human. Well, it's more like the myth of Narcissus, isn't it, David? The primal man looks at himself and falls in love with himself and falls into the world.
Yeah, so if you want the Hermetic creation story, there's actually four or five of them, and it depends on what you want to prioritize. So, yes, in the Poimandres, you have the God generates a perfect human. This perfect human is made up of nous and life and light, and then he comes into the world because he falls in love with his image mirrored in the face of nature. But if you're reading the Kori Kazmu, that character doesn't appear. All you have is God making souls in a big cauldron, and souls set in charge of the zodiac. And then it's the souls.
Bubble, toil and trouble.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, they never got the story quite straight. It's never like a creed, but yeah, I mean, I don't deny commonalities, unless of course the evil demiurge planted those commonalities, but, I urge everyone just to read the text together and see what you come up with. And, you know, that's that, if in the end, you know, we come up with different interpretations of the material, I think that's the beauty of this whole project. I think it's wonderful.
Lynchian.
Sure.
And yeah, I like how you, in your book, you do approach the idea of who Poimandra said, because the first definition is what, shepherd of men, and then there's the Peter Kingsley one, the thought of Ra. But you think that it's something else, right, David?
Yeah, and here again, I'm following Christian Bull and Howard Jackson. They found out, it was a revolutionary discovery, that an ancient pharaoh the Greeks pronounced his name as Poromanris. And it only takes a couple adjustments for Poromanris to change into Poimandris. And so I think that's probably right. But here's a case where, you know, you can have multiple explanations. I think, you know, by late antiquity, everyone had forgotten about Poromanres as a pharaoh, like that name. They didn't know that name anymore. And so, yeah, they understood Poimandres as the shepherd of men, because Poimen or Poimen means a shepherd and Andros means a man. So in a sense, like, it's, you have to look at what the original meaning meant and what the reception history is. And the reception history is just as important as any kind of original. But the most important thing you can do is just read the text yourself. And, you know, Poimandres says, "I am nous." So, you know, there you go. I mean, you don't have to speculate. You don't have to know all this historical information about his name. He tells you who he is exactly.
I always thought it was weird, you know, that Poimandres is teaching Hermes, whereas Hermes is supposed to be the big source of Hermeticism, thrice great and all this other stuff. And Hermes is usually the person that's the teacher, right? So how did that get reversed where Poimandres has to teach Hermes? And was Hermes a god? Was Hermes a person? What do you think?
Well, Hermes... there's a couple of things to say to that. Hermes has to go through the path of initiation himself to get to the point where he's a teacher. One of the tractates is called Nous to Hermes. And so he has, his teacher is Nous. Sometimes he calls that person Agathos Daimon. One of the ways the ancient Hermetists squared that circle is they said that, you know, there's Hermes the god and that there's Hermes the man and that those are different. There's also Hermes the planet, Mercury. And one of the reasons that, you know, Hermes is called thrice great in the Arab tradition is because he was born into a body three times, and on his third time, he remembered who he was.
It's pretty good.
Now that's definitely not the original meaning of his name, but that's again part of the creative reception history, that he was a dude way back when, you know, in the time of Isis and Osiris, who were an actual king and queen, and he gained actual wisdom. And so this wisdom is very, very, very ancient. But he's not equivalent to the god Hermes. So they made a distinction.
Fascinating. Yeah, and I know the Arabs and the Persians associated Hermes with Enoch. Again, like you said, his story just starts to gain traction and imagination, and he's just all over the place. He's a rock star. He's a rock star.
Now I know how Christianity got its foothold. It was so confusing with all these different things. They say, forget it. Here's this simple theology. Just believe it.
Didn't end up really simple.
Well, you know how things go.
Yeah. Once they brought in the Trinity, it was like, what have you done? Why? Why did you bring in the Trinity? Everything was fine. But, well, as we get to the end, as we all have things to do on this, well, for us, it's a moon day. For you, David, it's Mars day. But any super chats or last questions from you, Vance?
Yeah. Oh, I've had my fill tonight. I've had my time for sure. But Graham Pong has asked, are Hermeticism and alchemy inherently linked? What do you think, David?
Yeah, I'm not sure about inherently, but historically, yeah. So you've got alchemy. Alchemia is just the Egyptian science. That's what the word means. It's got an Arabic definite article, al, and then chemia is the native Egyptian word for Egypt itself. So alchemia is the Egyptian art. It probably arises, gets into full swing about the third century of the Common Era. And so people like Zosimus are into that sort of stuff. And Wouter Hanegraaff has recently argued that Zosimus was a hermetist. So if that's true, then yeah, they're definitely closely linked, closely tied. But yeah, I would say, you know, probably not earlier than the third century. A lot of the Hermetic texts are probably earlier than that. Alchemy takes some time to develop. But once it does develop, you find people wanting to attribute that wisdom back to Hermes because it's logical to attribute it back to the knower of all things, you know.
He's a magnet.
Just as today we might, you know, attribute the theory of relativity back to Hermes, not because we always knew it, you know, but because it's the great science of our day and it's really cool. And so Hermes must have known it way before Einstein. Kind of.
he didn't tell us though, did he?
Well, he told you just didn't understand the symbols.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like if say you saying that Plato learned from Moses or that Hermes was hanging around with Moses and all these wonderful wild stories, huh?
Man, well, here we got another non-question super chat that I wanted to acknowledge, and from Freighter RC Hermetic Podcast. RC, that's Rosicrucis. I guess maybe he might be associated with the Rosicrucians there. But anyway.
Thank you, Eloquent. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, appreciate it.
And then also, in case you don't ask, Miguel, Artivus wanted to know if, David, is your new book available in hardback?
So, yeah, currently the Amazon Empire doesn't make it at all useful for me to put it in hardback, but I'm going to be talking with none other than Frauder RC about possibly getting out a hardback edition. So yeah, stay tuned for that. I think it deserves to be in hardback. It's just that, you know, basically the way the market works is, you know, Amazon gives you much less, you know, because it costs more to produce the book. But there may be a hack around this, I'll see what I can do. But I know some people just, you know, are able to get it done themselves as well. If they get the paperback, they just get it rebound. But stay tuned on that one.
Awesome. Awesome. I have the link on the show notes, people. Highly recommend you get it. I have David's homepage. But tell David what you got going. I just saw your message. You're doing a course on Valentinos. Just in time for Valentine's Day, I'm sure. But tell what you got cooking with your courses, David.
Yeah, so I really want to provide a service to everybody in your audience and beyond. So I hope that you will support me and share those links. I've got a number of course offerings, which I hope that you'll take. Obviously, if you're into the Hermetica, I've got my own full-blown course on the Hermetica. I've recently figured out that a way to kind of combine all my courses into one big bundle, which I'm calling the Gnosis Academy. And I can share that link with Miguel if he wants, but it's on my website and other places. This will give you access to what I consider like my best-selling courses, I guess, which was the Marcion course and Gnostic literature, where I go through every text of Nag Hammadi, and also Simon of Sumeria, aka Simon Magus, and also now recently Valentinus. So Valentinus is this awesome figure, and if you don't know, there's been a revolution in the study of Valentinus, because we've rediscovered a complete letter of Valentinus. And so this is just absolutely, you know, cutting edge research, and it's really time to revisit him. It's our very first full letter, and it's absolutely revolutionary. But what I do in the course with Valentinus is I go through the eight fragments that are recognized as his. And I just, you know, I just go through them one by one, giving you the full spiritual historical commentary. And I give you all my translations, everything fresh, everything I've written about the topic. So I'm hoping that people will take advantage of this, because this is new and cutting edge research. And if anybody, you know, has any more suggestions for courses, or just wants to check out the full lineup, the best place to go is my website, just mdavidlitwa.com/courses. And I hope that many of you will take advantage, because you're not going to get this anywhere else.
No way you're not. And yeah, as soon as I get my financial house in order, I want to join your course. Might be the next president, who knows? But I do. But I know it's, your stuff is very valuable, and it's useful, and it's approachable. And again, there's nothing like it, unless you went to Rice University, you know, paid a lot of money or something like that. You're not going to find it anywhere.
Oh, God, yeah.
Or even a university, you're just not going to find it. So unless you go to Holland and Walter or something. But most people can't do that. But yeah, check it out for sure. And it's great. And for the audience, yeah, support David, support the show. We will be having a show on the Kabbalah and the clip out this week. And next week, we will return to Gnosticism with the Valentinians, with the tripart tractate. We'll do a show on that. Real quick, David, Gospel of Truth, Valentinus, yay or nay? Because it seems nay seems to be more or less the consensus.
You know, it's funny. Yeah. Overwhelmingly, I've seen scholars now say nay, but I am definitely a yay. And one of the reasons I am is because of this new letter that we've got. Well, it's a long story. It's actually an old letter, but we didn't recognize that it was from Valentinus until just recently. So I think this totally reopens the question. And I plan to say a lot more about that in the course. Good. And in a forthcoming book on Valentinus. Probably again through the gods of Amazon. So bear with me, support me so that I can write that book, and you'll get to see the results.
Awesome. Can't wait to see your evidence. Well, we are at the end. Thanks everybody for coming onto the chat. Good questions, good comments. As always, Vance, thanks for keeping us company.
Oh, I was delighted to learn more about Hermeticism. And, you know, we just scratched the surface. We didn't even get into some of the characteristics of the, you know, Hermetic corpus. So I don't know, maybe another session sometime.
Get his book. It's just his commentary. Boom, boom, boom. You'll be there.
Yeah. Sounds great.
And then, yeah. And then when you're in the shower, just read the book.
You have a waterproof version? Does Amazon?
Well, we'll get it on Audible eventually. Yeah.
There you go. That's waterproof.
Awesome. Well, David, as always, really appreciate your time and coming on the show, and appreciate everything you do to keep this knowledge going and growing.
Thank you. I consider you all fellow travelers on the path of Gnosis. So thank you for what you do. And everyone, take care. Enjoy Amen. The evening.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in / promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.